In the summer of 1941, President Franklin Roosevelt had a very curious meeting. He met with an attorney. The attorney was an up-and-coming fellow in political circles. The attorney's name was William Donovan. He had a nickname, Wild Bill. Wild Bill Donovan. He had, in fact, earned the Congressional Medal of Honor during World War I. And in the previous year, 1940, early in 1941, he had done extensive traveling in Europe, war-torn Europe. And in the course of his travels, he encountered a number of people whom he had known for years since World War I, people especially who were British. And a number of people he encountered were involved in British intelligence, espionage circles. And they pulled William Donovan aside and they said, "You need to get word to your country's president, Franklin D. Roosevelt. He needs to know the United States must have, going forward, an intelligence, a foreign intelligence gathering apparatus." We did not. We had the FBI, but no specific intelligence apparatus organization for gathering foreign intelligence. And so Donovan gave it some thought and came up with a plan, and through channels was able to set up an appointment to meet with Franklin Roosevelt in the Oval Office. And he pitched his plan, and here was his plan. He said, "I would like to head up an organization, an office. I have a lot of contacts all over the world. I will get contacts that are amenable, friendly with the United States, to send to us intelligence about what's going on at various places in the world. I will report directly to you, Mr. President. This should be funded by secret funds." He knew there were secret funds in the White House, a White House slush fund. "This will be a channel for you, Mr. President, to get intelligence from all over the world secretly. I will meet with you regularly, report to you alone." And Roosevelt loved the idea. It just appealed to him. Here's a way he could secretly get information from everywhere, all over the world. So he said to Bill Donovan, "Do it." So Bill Donovan established what he called the Office of Strategic Services. You may not have heard of that, but you probably have heard of its descendant, the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency. He began to establish, he set up an office in Washington, D.C., and within months, we were at war after Pearl Harbor, and his schedule, Donovan's schedule, just erupted. He was extremely busy setting up contacts everywhere, particularly in Europe, but also the Middle East and Asia. And in addition, Donovan had to travel between Washington, D.C., where he had his new office, but he had a law firm in New York City, and he lived in New York City, had been living in New York City. So he was going back and forth, driving his staff crazy with all of his travel and all of his travel plans, especially his administrative assistant, a woman named Eloise Page. She repeatedly had to call the Pennsylvania Railroad to, at the last minute, arrange a ticket for Donovan to get on a train and travel to New York City. And all of this came to a head one Friday. He had that day flip-flopped back and forth with regard to going from D.C. up to New York. He had said at the beginning of the day, "I got to go. I'm going to go for the weekend up to the city." And then he changed. "No, I can't do it. I can't." And then he, back and forth until late in the day, he was about to leave the office, and he told Eloise, "You know, I am not going to go. I'm not going to New York." And she said, "Yes, you are." He said, "What did you say?" She said, "You are going to New York City. I had to call the Pennsylvania Railroad and get them to add a special car to the train so you would have a seat on the train. If you don't go, we will look silly. You're going." She grabbed his coat, she grabbed his briefcase, handed it to him and said, "Get." He said, "Yes, ma'am." And he did. No one wants to look silly. And this morning, you're going to discover, I believe, some steps you can take to avoid looking silly. And they're found in the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 10, verse 1. and following. Ecclesiastes, I believe the thoughts found here were composed by ancient Jewish King Solomon. It's very possible that they were constituted in the form we find them today by a later scribe in the era of Ezra. But Solomon originated these thoughts. The first half of the book is all about Solomon's assessment of life. Life is, he felt, empty. He described it as vanity, and that word means, in effect, it comes from a root that means mist or fog. It's like this morning's fog. It's here for a while, and then it dissipates. It passes. It's fleeting. Life is so fleeting and transitory. And in the face of that, Solomon added in the second half of this book, from chapter 7 on, counsel for living life in the face of its fleetingness, its apparent emptiness. And the first thing he said, beginning in chapter 7, was you got to enjoy the things you have in life, the relationships, the good things, working, eating. The second thing he said was go for it. The stuff you have in life that you're doing, pour your heart into what you're doing. Pour all that you are into what you're doing. Pour your soul into it. And then just before, at the very end of chapter 9, he added a caveat. He said, do not assume that merely because you've poured your heart into what you're doing, don't assume necessarily you will succeed. You may succeed, or you may not. A lot of weird things happen in life. Bad things can muck up good stuff. And look at verse 1, chapter 10. You'll see what I mean. As dead flies give perfume a bad smell, so a little folly outweighs wisdom and honor. And I have to tell you, for years, the first part of verse 10, it's caused me to wrinkle my brow. Wait a minute, dead flies... Really? Do dead flies really cause perfume to smell bad? I mean, should we take a vial of Chanel No. 5 and drop some dead flies in there and just wait a couple of days? Do you really, really think dead flies will ruin the smell of a perfume? I mean, honestly, when I was young, elementary aged or so, a time came in my life when I realized that at Christmas, here's another Christmas thing, Rick, we're really off this today. Anyway, I realized that Christmas shouldn't be just about me getting gifts, but I ought to give gifts. And I thought of my mother. I ought to give my mom a gift. But I was, late elementary age, maybe junior high, middle school. And what do you give a woman for Christmas? I had seen on TV that I'd sometimes seen that men give women perfume. And I thought to myself, and I was just a little guy, I thought, well, maybe I could do that. I did chores around the house. So mom and dad gave me a weekly allowance. I had a little cash. So one day, a few weeks before Christmas, I must have been, 10 or 11 years old. A few weeks before Christmas, I took my little cash stash to the local drugstore, and I found that they had very cheap perfume. And I saw this I can afford. It even came in a box, so I could easily wrap it. And so I bought one for my mom, and I think I must have had my father wrap it, and I felt so proud of myself, and I gave my mother this perfume for Christmas. And mom, bless her heart, she was so gracious. She expressed gratitude, thanked me. I don't think she ever wore it once because it was cheap perfume. It wasn't that there were dead flies in it. What is this? It's a very interesting thing. The light bulb for me came on when I some time ago translated this from the original Hebrew. The opening phrase, as dead flies, can be and literally should be translated flies of death. As flies of death. Now that has caused endless squabbling among scholars and commentators about the meaning of that phrase. So it can mean dead insects, dead bugs, or it can mean an insect that purveys death by its bite. That is to say, its bite is poisonous, like a mosquito carrying the West Nile virus. Bitten by it, one will die, or particularly in those days. So think about that. So let's suppose that happens. You're bitten by a bug of death, a mosquito carrying a virus. In the ancient Middle East, when Solomon composed these thoughts, what would then happen? You die. And when you die, what would happen? They would take your body and they would wrap it like a shroud in cloth, wouldn't they? And then what would they do? They would soak the body wrapped in cloth with perfumed, expensive oil. Perfume, in effect. So the body would be perfumed. But a few days later, you would not be able to smell the perfume. The whole thing would reek because of the decomposition of the body. You see, the flies of death eventually, look at what Solomon wrote, look at how he put it. Flies of death give perfume a bad smell. That's exactly what Solomon had in mind here. A little insect bite, though poisonous, causes perfume to eventually smell bad from the decomposition of the body. And so Solomon said, I want to tell you something. That illustrates an important principle regarding life, relative to life. So as flies of death give perfume a bad smell, so, meaning in the same way, a little folly outweighs wisdom and honor. The word outweighs, the Hebrew word means it's more expensive. It costs you more. A little bit of foolish costs you a lot more than honor and wisdom. It weighs more. It costs more. It overwhelms wisdom and honor. Just like the bite of the fly of death overwhelms an expensive perfume. A little bit of foolishness overwhelms a lot of wisdom. Overwhelms a lot of honor. A life lived honorably with wisdom can be sullied by a little foolish behavior. That's his point. We can taint years of living honorably with just a little foolish behavior. A couple years after Donovan established the OSS, 1943, December of 1943, as part of his efforts to build the whole intelligence gathering apparatus in the OSS, he made a trip. World War II is raging both in Europe and in the Pacific. He made a trip to mainland China. He wanted to establish some contacts in mainland China. He knew of a man who sort of had given leadership to a significant part of intelligence gathering in China. The man's name was General Tai Li. And so Donovan went to China to sort of see if he could make inroads there and establish a base of operations so that there would be, we would get cooperation from the Chinese for intelligence gathering in China for the Pacific Theater of War. So while I was there, one evening, the Chinese put on a lavish banquet in William Donovan's honor. It's beautiful, a marvelous thing, but there was a huge problem. Donovan had come hoping to get permission from General Tai Li for the OSS to have agents operating, gathering intelligence in mainland China, and Donovan had been repeatedly, during his visit, put off, and so they're at this banquet, and it's supposedly in his honor, and he's just ticked. And finally, in the middle of the banquet, he just erupted. Donovan looked at the general, General Tai Li, and he said, General, I want you to know, I am going to send my agents in here whether you like it or not. Tai Li was taken aback. He looked and he said, you do that. You operate, you have your people operate here without my authority. I will kill every one of your agents here. Donovan clenched his fist and began pounding it on the, this is in a banquet, pounding it on the table, you know, the tea and cups rattling. He said, for every one of my agents you kill, I will kill one of your agents. Tai Li said, you can't talk to me that way. Donovan screamed back, I am talking to you that way. And that was a lovely event. So much for honor. So what happens? How is it that we can taint honor like that by our foolish behavior? What kind of behavior? Look at this. Look at verse 2. The heart of the wise inclines to the right, but the heart of the fool to the left. Solomon here employed an ancient metaphor. In ancient literature, often the right metaphorically referred to what is morally, ethically right, and the left to its opposite, what is morally, ethically wrong. And so Solomon said, the person who wants inside to do the right thing, that person's wise. The person who is inclined to just continually do the wrong thing, that is foolish. Foolishness involves a heart gravitating toward wrong, gravitating that way repeatedly. So the heart of a person who is just has a pattern of moving to the wrong, the things that displease God, that are disobedient. The Lord says, our God says, that's foolish. And that foolishness, just a little bit of it, costs lots in wisdom and honor. And he offered a thought about that. So how does that work? So you're moving. You have this tendency to move to the wrong, and it costs you. Well, how so? What does that look like? Look at the text. Look at verse 3. All right. Even as he walks along the road, the fool lacks sense and shows everyone how stupid he is. This is so complimentary. It's just lovely. Be careful. The opening phrase, even as he walks along the road, that is again a metaphor, an ancient metaphor for living your everyday life. So even as this person lives every day, notice a phrase. If you mark in your Bibles, if you're reading from a Bible, underline the phrase, the fool lacks sense. It is exquisite in the original. The word sense is the Hebrew word that means heart. He lacks, she lacks heart. You do that. You live every day, and you're just habitually avoiding the right. You're leaning to the wrong. A person doing that, he says, lacks heart. Actually, now remember, for the ancients, the word heart, we think of it as calling to mind emotion or feeling. To Solomon, that's not what it called to mind. It called to mind more the sense of understanding. And the word lack here, the Hebrew word is chasar. And it means to want or be without, or listen to this, or to be diminished. Read it that way. You live every day and you're just inclined to do wrong stuff. You are diminishing heart or diminishing understanding. You are increasingly clueless, living in an increasingly clueless way. Foolishness, I think, also involves cluelessness in lifestyle. You do this and you do this and you are increasingly diminishing understanding, and you wind up acting in a foolhardy way, so often a destructive way. And I'll show you an example. Now, here is where I got to warn you. This gets really personal. Verse 3 again. All right. Even as he walks along the road, the fool lacks sense and shows, circle that word, everyone how stupid he is. I was shocked when I translated this from the original, because the word shows does not mean shows. The Hebrew word is amar, which means to say. To say. Huh. And it's in a perfect tense. Literally, if you were to translate that literally, it reads, for all he said, he's a fool. That's a literal translation. For all he said, he's a fool. Now, what does that mean? Here is a person who sort of gravitates toward doing the wrong stuff. And he looks at everyone, she looks at everyone, and tends to say, what a fool. That's what it means. Foolishness involves, I think, thirdly, commonly dismissing others as inferior. Idiots. Idiots. Jerks. And I gotta tell you, you know what occurred to me? Driving. driving in the car, driving along, someone does something that annoys you, and you whisper under your breath, "Idiot! Fool! Jerk!" Back in November 26, 2000, the AP ran a report about a guy named Wesley Ridgewell. He'd been detained by the authorities because he had run, listen to this, he'd run through a freeway toll booth without paying toll. You say, well, they arrest people for that? They had 705 pictures of him doing it. Pictures. 705 times, started in August of 1999 through June of 2000, more than 700 times. That's a lot of tolls. The funny thing about it was he was easy to identify from the photos because he had personalized license plates. And his license plate read. Now, if you might just write these letters down, two groups of letters so you get it. The first group of letters was JST. The second group of letters was CRZY. Just crazy! Uh-huh. And you say, I've driven by that guy. I see him every day. Crazy. Nuts. I have an assignment for you. Every day this week, and when you go out driving, grab a little card or a piece of paper and write four words on it and keep it on the dashboard or the console. And the four words are, they are not idiots. Remember, routinely calling others an idiot, a jerk, that in itself is a manifestation of foolish behavior. It's a quality of foolishness. Keep your cool. Wise people keep their cool. And there is a much more important manifestation of this whole wise people keeping their cool and not calling others jerks principle. It is so important. Look at verse 4. You'll see what I mean. If a ruler's anger rises against you, do not leave your post. Calmness can lay great errors to rest. The word ruler refers not merely to governmental rulers. It refers to those in authority over you. That could be your boss, a teacher at school, any authority. It could be a governmental authority. Authority over you. So let's, and the thing called to mind here, so let's suppose an authority, your boss, your supervisor, your manager, literally the Hebrew reads, his spirit goes up against you. Her spirit goes up. It refers to criticism. Your supervisor is annoyed with you and barks at you or speaks a word of sharp criticism and it stings. Stanley Baldwin was at one point a prime minister in England, sometime before Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill opposed him. They were from opposing political parties. And when Winston Churchill came to power, at one point thereafter, on one occasion, some of Stanley Baldwin's friends were putting together a tribute for Stanley Baldwin for his 80th birthday. And they contacted Churchill, and they said, would you be willing to give us, you know, like a testimonial for Stanley Baldwin in honor of his 80th birthday? Churchill replied, quote, I wish Stanley Baldwin no ill, but it would have been much better if he had never lived. So how do you really feel? How does it feel when someone criticizes you like that? That doesn't feel good. That's awful. And so what do you do? What do you do? Huh? I'll show you what you shouldn't do. Notice he says, so a ruler's anger rises against you, you're criticized. Do not leave. Literally, the Hebrew reads, your position, your place. Don't walk out. That's what we want to do. You know, I'm so out of here. I don't have to sit and listen to that jerk. And there again is that calling another person an idiot thing going on there. Savvy people keep their cool, first of all, by hanging in there when they're criticized. They don't bail, they don't run, they don't ditch, they don't leave in a huff, they don't storm out slamming the door on the way out. They stay. You say, but Jerry, I mean, it hurt me. The word stung. I know. So how do you sit there? What do you do? How do you keep your cool? Notice, if a ruler's anger rises against you, do not leave your post. Watch this last line. Calmness can lay great errors to rest. I love the word calmness. It comes from the Hebrew root that rapha is what it sounds like in the Hebrew. It means to heal or cure. And it has here, it's in a form that has the idea of being a restorative or a remedy or something that, in other words, the sense of it is focus on fixing, focus on making things healthier. How do you keep your cool? I'll tell you one way you do it, by focusing on healing. By focusing on not fighting, not ditching, not running, but how can I fix this? So someone criticizes you sharply, and it hurts. Don't split. Pray. And think to yourself, and pray, Lord, all right, what can I do here to make things a little healthier? That's it. That's it right there. You may not fix it entirely. You may not change the boss's mind. What can I do to make this context healthier? I mentioned Winston Churchill. A woman met him. She was the daughter of H.H. Asquith, who became prime minister long before Churchill did. Her name was Violet Asquith, and the two of them met at a dinner party in 1906. Violet was 19 years old. Churchill was in his early 30s. And many, many years later, when Churchill had become prime minister, Violet Asquith was sort of reminiscing and recalling the time when she first met Winston Churchill. It was at a dinner party. And they didn't connect at first, but they began to talk during the party. And at one point, he asked her, well, how old are you? She was 19. He said, well, I'm 32. And then he said, I just curse our mortality. How cruelly short is the allotted time we have to do all that we should do. And then he said something remarkable. He said, you know, really, we're all worms, but I believe that I'm a glowworm. I tell you, I really love that. I really do. So you're made to feel like a worm. How can you bring light to the darkness? What can you do to bring health to that awful context? When you do that, when you refuse to leave, when you refuse to storm out, something happens. Notice the text. He said, calmness can lay great errors to rest. Great errors means bigger mistakes. And I was really surprised by the verb translated lay to rest. Nuoth is how it sounds in the Hebrew. It means to cause, in this form, to cause to rest or to make cease or to stop. You do that. You don't storm out. You pray and ask, how can I make this thing healthier? You prevent greater problems. If you erupt and angrily storm out, you will tend to make matters worse. Keep your cool by a commitment to not make the problem worse. You focus on restoration. You focus on, let's say you're serving, a ministry, and someone over you, there's a conflict. Think restoration. Think health. Think, how can I make relationships healthier? At work, you're in a tense situation and you've been criticized. Again, pray. In fact, I would invite you this week, pray tomorrow and ask God, okay, Lord, what is one thing I can do this week to make some relationship in my life, at work or at school or at home, one thing I can do, one step that I can take this week to make things a little healthier in that relationship? What's one thing? God, give me one thing. Because there's something you have to understand. Oh, man. Look at verse 5. There is There is an evil I have seen under the sun. The sort of error that arises from a ruler. This is Solomon at the end of his life, I believe, reminiscing. And he says, you know, I have seen something. He suggests here a couple of important principles that will help you cool your jets when you want to just rip it. Solomon says, I've seen something really nasty in my life. I have seen repeatedly leaders, people in high places, make profound boo-boos. And I suspect Solomon had himself in mind as well as others. He's saying, look, I've seen leaders make a lot of mistakes. So you're at work tomorrow, and your supervisor is heading in a direction that appears to you to be just way off. Or you're serving in a ministry, and the person directing the ministry is doing something you're thinking, this is not going to work. Solomon says, well, guess what? Look at the beginning of verse 6. Look at verse 6. Fools are put in many high positions while the rich occupy the low ones. What surprised me is the verb translated are put is the Hebrew word that means to give. A literal translation of that is not fools, but foolishness or folly gave in many high places. Meaning, folly makes a contribution, it gives, there is input, folly has input in high places everywhere. Wherever you go, in high places, in circles of authority, folly has a foothold. Foolishness has a foothold. Humanly speaking, human authorities are generally not entirely without foolishness. Leaders, make mistakes. Keep your cool because no leader is perfect. And that's the interesting thing. No matter where you go. So let's say you're criticized or someone's taking a terrible step and you leave or you resign or you split and you go somewhere else. Eventually, you'll be tempted to think these leaders are idiots. Same thing. That's what Solomon says. He says, I've noticed this interesting thing. Wherever I go, leaders make mistakes because folly has input in high circles everywhere. Wherever you go. Wherever you go, you'll wind up thinking the same thing. How can they do that? How can they be doing this? They're idiots. And there's something else you should remember. Something profound. Something that blew Solomon away. The last line of verse 6 reads, while the rich occupy the low ones. And I believe the next two lines, all of verse 7, follow the same thought. Look at verse 7. I've seen slaves on horseback while princes go on foot like slaves. Now, okay, what do you hear there? Let me read it again. The rich occupy low positions. Slaves are on horseback. Princes are on foot like slaves. It's all topsy-turvy for Solomon. This is nuts. You have rich people living in hovels. You have a prince who's walking around like a slave, and you have a slave riding a white charger like a prince would do. It's topsy-turvy. It's not right. It's unthinkable. How can this be? Another story from World War II. One Sunday, it says July 25th, 1943. Hot Sunday afternoon, the figurehead king of Italy, and I frankly didn't even know there was such a person, even under the reign of Benito Mussolini, Italy had a king. He was a figurehead. His name was King Victor Emmanuel III. And this particular Sunday, July 25th, he summoned Il Duce, Benito Mussolini, to meet him at the royal residence. This was not unusual. They met every week to talk, to chat. Mussolini had been Italy's premier for 21 years, meaning his absolute iron-fisted dictator, but they met. And so Il Duce arrived, and the king met him at the front door, ushered him into the royal residence. Things had not been going well for Italy in the war. By this time, their troops had been driven out of North Africa by the Allies. They were right in the process of being driven off the island of Sicily, and everyone knew the Allied forces are going to invade Italy very soon. So things were not looking good for Mussolini. So they're sitting, they sat down, and once they'd settled a bit, the king volunteered, well, things aren't really going well, are they? And Mussolini couldn't argue the point. It was obvious, everyone knew it. And then the king added a very curious observation. He said, you know, yesterday, the Grand Council passed a motion that amounts to a vote of no confidence in you, Duce. Duce didn't give a rip. He'd ruled for 21 years. The king said, you know, rumors have reached me that the military, they're widely on the verge of mutiny. Duce wasn't worried. He'd ruled for 21 years. What did he care? And then the king said, you know, the feelings of the council and the feelings of the military, they're shared by the common person in our country. And Mussolini was fed up, and he just kind of blew it off. He said, so I should tender my resignation. And the king said, I have to tell you, I accept it unconditionally. And then Mussolini happened to glance outside, saw his car surrounded by Italian police, and the doors guarded by police. He was placed under house arrest. Shocked. Things never go in this life entirely as you expect. Keep your cool. Things will never turn out exactly as we expect. That's the way it is. That's life under the sun. That's how it works. And so could I just appeal to you today? Relinquish the urge that you feel to have everything go your way. Because the longer you hold on to that urge, I gotta control it, it's gotta go my way, the more frustrated you will become. Because it won't work. So take a deep breath and loosen your grip. And understand that even when things are going the opposite of the direction you deem best, you're not God. And He can handle it. Father, I thank you. I thank you for this truth. I thank you that you can handle it. That we don't have to control everything. And then when everything appears to us to be reeling out of control in an odd direction, you got that. It's okay. You have it under control. You will work it for your glory. We thank you that we can rest in that certainty. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.